Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
My guest today has had an avid interest in history since the age of 10, when he visited a recently opened Etruscan tomb. Richard Hurley is also interested in languages and medieval European history, which he studied at Harvard. While there, he was a staff writer for the Harvard Lampoon. Richard Hurley is also co-author, along with T.J. Meekins, of a book of historical fiction, Queen of the Northern Mines. As they traveled across Northern California presenting multimedia shows on historical topics, Richard discovered that almost no present-day Californian knows the true story of our state's experience of the Civil War. He has now written a book of nonfiction, California and the Civil War. Richard Hurley, welcome.
Thank you, Nancy. It's very nice to be here.
So your previous book got you interested in the Civil War in California, but you're living in Nevada City, Grass Valley area, which was, I didn't realize, was a hotbed of sentiment about the Civil War.
A very nicely divided sentiment, and it gave rise to a number of very rough incidents. As it happens, Nevada City was settled primarily by people from the north, New England and upstate New York, and Grass Valley, which is only 4 miles away, ended up being settled largely by folks from the south or Irish men who were sympathetic largely to the Southern cause. So there were a lot of bad evenings in local bars.
That's so surprising, because right now, if you're in an automobile, you don't even know when you cross from Grass Valley to Nevada City. It's so close, like you say, 4 miles away, and yet there were strong sentiments and contrary sentiments.
There's a road called Town Talk Road where the different parties would go to meet halfway between the two communities, presumably to prevent violence.
So you lived in various places, but you ended up in your now in this area that is surrounded by history. So you must have gotten interested in that history. Is that what caused you and your co-author, T.J. Meekins, to write this novel that you wrote?
It was Terry who done it. She gave me a book on California history that included a stagecoach robbery that actually netted quite a bit of money, $52,000 at the time in gold and silver.
I thought, in 19th century money?
Yeah.
Wow. That's quite a haul.
Multiply it by 28, all you math fans in the audience. And so I said, okay, good enough. And then I got to the end of the account, and I read that the robbers handed over a note to the stagecoach driver. And the note was a receipt from the Confederate States of America. They were doing a little outdoor fundraising for Jefferson Davis. And it turned out, my first thought was, there's villains rarely lack for invention to describe their activities. And I thought, okay, that's their excuse. And I just assumed the money went to the nearest bar and brothel. But in fact, the author of that note was exactly who he said he was. He was a Confederate officer, formal or informal, who had fought in Missouri, had participated in the horrible partisan warfare that swept through Missouri, and he was out in California to try to do the same out here. And I'm glad to report that the local law enforcement authorities were able to quell the activity, but it cost quite a number of lives. There were a series of gun battles, serious gun battles, and one of the robbers was ultimately hanged for his role.
Well, do we actually still have that note that he wrote?
I think Wells Fargo has it. If I were them, I'd keep it anyway. There is a copy of it around somewhere. Yeah. Fantastic artifact. And then once I learned that was the trigger. I've just said, okay, California wasn't quite the Union bastion that I had assumed from looking at maps of the 1860 election, where it shows up nicely in the same color as all the northern states. It went for Lincoln.
So there was never any doubt that California would be on the Union side.
Yeah, and then the more I read about it, the more the real miracle that happened out here was that we didn't have a war. We had some partisan activities, but the reality was that demographically, California was a border state. We had 28% of the people in this state vote for Breckinridge in the 1860 election. This is the gentleman who later went on to be one of the Confederacy's leading generals. A vote for Breckinridge was effectively a vote for secession. Okay, so I learned that, and I began to get a little more interested. And then further reading revealed that, in fact, California had been a handmaiden to the South for the first 10 years of our existence as a state. Our representatives in Washington, both senators and representatives, were Southerners, and they aligned themselves with the bloc from the Deep South. And so, you know, at this point, I was definitely interested. And the rest of it turned into a multimedia show, which we took around to promote.
Because you have a background in visual, what would you call what you studied at Harvard, besides
visual studies,
European,
they called it then. Yes.
Visual studies.
Yes. It was a pre-architecture major, and I actually ended up getting a master's degree in architecture.
From Berkeley, UC Berkeley.
From Berkeley, right. But over the years, what I've done with my visual training mostly has been computer-based graphics and multimedia animation. So I really like visuals as a communication tool. And so in the book, for instance, there are 108 pictures in this book. And I have to credit T.J. Meekins, my co-author and Queen of the Northern Mines, who is a magician of the internet. She goes online there and she finds images that tell the story viscerally. So, for instance, it's one thing to write about the tensions in Washington that were so acute in the 1850s. And it's another to look at an engraving of a U.S. senator aiming a loaded pistol at the heart of another U.S. senator who disagrees with him on the bill that's being debated. That really happened. And in fact, the representatives and senators went armed to work in that decade.
Well, I want to get back to your presentation that you and T.J. Meekins did together, because you came here to Chico, this was a few years ago, and did a presentation at the library that was just really well done.
Oh, thank
you. Thoroughly engrossing, and I could see how you drew on your background, because you did such an expert job of your presentation, and I thoroughly enjoyed that.
Well, great. It was corporate training and also educational programming that we did before, multimedia, and the tools work. You know, I really believe them. So now we're getting a chance to work on a few subjects that we'd rather write about than, say, mainframe programming tutorials.
So I think it was this, when you were taking your show on the road, so to speak, and giving these presentations, that you realized that you weren't the only one who didn't know a lot about California's experience during the Civil War. Because when I read your first, it was a historical novel, your first book was, and I was amazed at what I did not know, but I understand that I'm...
You're in good company,
because
we go to selected audiences. We went to historical societies and museums and genealogical societies, people who have a strong interest in history, and the standard response to the show is, I didn't know any of that. thank you for letting me hear about it, because there was a lot of crazy stuff that happened out here. People.
Well, we weren't looking this direct. I say we because I grew up in the deep, deep South, and there was a Confederate cemetery closer to my house than my post office or the grocery store or any of those things. There was a Confederate cemetery right there, so I grew up surrounded by Civil War history, and never heard a word about what was going on in California. Now, I was instructed, and I noticed this in your book, because we would have essay contest. The United Daughters of the Confederacy would sponsor an essay contest, and we were instructed to use the term, the phrase, war between the states.
That's pretty good. Usually it's the war of northern aggression.
Yes, that's another one used in the South, too. The war of northern aggression. We Southerners framed that in such a way that, well, it was not a civil war. You can't call it a civil war. It was the war of northern aggression.
Yes. Yes, and our politics are still with us today, as anybody listening to recent news is well aware. So this is a serious subject, and it did affect California. When the sesquicentennial happened, there were a lot of shows on NPR, and the callers from California would call in plaintively and said, gee, I wish we had had something to do with the Civil War. And well, my first reaction is anytime you can avoid getting hit by a 58 caliber bullet, is, you know, you want to take that option. Don't do that. But the truth is that people did not leave their politics back east. They came out here to get rich. It took a lot of guts. It took a lot of determination and a fair amount of money. And so when they got out here, they wanted to keep looking for the gold. But that didn't mean that they suddenly stopped thinking the way they and their peers thought. So California was an incredibly tense place as the nation underwent that final slide down into war. And in fact, we have the honor of being the only state in the Union whose Chief Justice of the Supreme Court shot and killed its U.S. Senator in a duel.
Yeah, that's over, just horrifying. Yeah, today.
Essentially over slavery, yeah. Yeah, and California at that time was a very violent place. It led the nation in terms of murder rates and dueling. So the fact that we didn't slide off into a horrible Kansas or Missouri-style conflagration was the story, really. How did that happen? And I, you know, the more I read, the more I asked myself that, you know, what was missing here? Yeah.
My guest is Richard Hurley, and his new book is California and the Civil War. And it not only is a written story, but you mentioned the photographs in this book. And yeah. I wanted to ask you about that because I found myself staring into the faces of these people. And one in particular caught my attention because it was a picture of a young man in 1859, juxtaposed with this same man's photograph just 4 years later, 1863. Do you remember that photograph?
Very well.
And I was shocked.
I remain grateful to the collector who let me. Those are otherwise unpublished pictures. And yes, the young man was a leader of the California 100. Sewell Reed was his name. He was a transplanted fellow from Boston, and he raised a cavalry troop to go back east and fight. He felt that strongly about the Union. And so he made a deal with the governor of Massachusetts. And
Now this comes later in the story.
Yes,
right,
that's
now,
1863.
I just wanted to comment on the photograph of this Captain Reed.
Oh, yeah.
Because he looks young and he's sitting there very formally in the first photograph. 1859.
And that photograph is actually brushed in with gold if you get to see the original. Now, we had to work in black and white, but it's a very decorative photo of a young man.
His epaulets looked like they would be gold, probably the buttons, his sword. And then here, right next to that, just 4 years later, he looks like an old man.
And he died within 3 months of that photo being taken.
Oh, my.
Yeah, it was a terrible attrition that took place among those brave men who went back east to fight.
Well, I also want to ask you about the photographs on your cover. The back cover is the man in the center of the back cover. There are a lot of men in this photograph, but was the subject of a TV series. And you may be too young to remember, and
no,
I really don't remember.
I do. I remember it very well. John Mosby, The Gray Ghost.
That's what the name of the program was, on TV. It was black and white TV then, and he inspired this TV series.
Well, it was his men actually that killed Sewell Reed. The unenviable job of the Californians who went back east was to try to chase Mosby down, and Mosby is probably the most dangerous partisan leader this country has ever produced.
Well, that's your back cover photograph.
Yes.
On the front cover, you have three very interesting faces. I think most people don't think of Indians, Native Americans, that is, when they think of the Civil War. But so you have a picture of a Native American up in the top corner of your book. And then you have a very young man. We often see these children in uniform.
Yes.
And then you have a very stern picture of a gentleman that I really wasn't familiar with until I read your book. And he is looks like he's glaring.
He is a Puritan general. He could have been in Oliver Cromwell's army very easily. Yes.
So you have these photographs of three people. And then underneath that, on the cover of your book, is a really interesting photograph of a large crowd. And we learn when we read your book why that crowd gathered. There was a very charismatic speaker.
You can't see him. In fact, you could have been 20 feet away and not seen him because he was only
five foot two. And you know what I wondered, too, without some kind of amplification, I don't see how these people even heard his voice. This tiny little guy that barely weighed more than I do.
He had a striking bass voice that just went rolling over the crowd. A lot of people remarked on it, that you'd go to the event, it'd be advertised, and you'd look around for the great speaker, and you couldn't see him in the first place. You'd see a little tuft of hair over the lectern, but his voice apparently was really powerful. And yes, you can see that. That's Market Street in San Francisco. It's at the critical point where California isn't sure whether it's going to stay in the Union. Nobody knows what's coming down. And Starr King was an incredibly gifted orator who had trained himself.
And this photograph is so clear. You can read the banners there of the people who have gathered to hear him. You can read the banners. Now, you say T.J. Meekins, your co-author, Terry, helped with the visuals in this book.
Yes,
also.
Definitely.
And so I'm guessing this is something that she found on the internet, perhaps?
We actually saw it on the cover of an historical magazine that we get called the Territorial Quarterly. That's a journal of California history. So the photograph has been known and used before. That's not one of the unknown ones that we came up with, but it's been it's rare to see it, and it's just a wonderful photograph for that very reason. Those quotes are from Daniel Webster, and they're from his impassioned defense of the Union in a debate in the Senate.
My guest is Richard Hurley, and he has a new book, California and the Civil War, and we were looking at the cover. Photographs on his cover, but you also worked at the Oakland Museum, restoring artifacts and designing exhibits there before you went back to Berkeley to get a master's in architecture. So you do have experience with these historical exhibits and
with California history. Oddly enough, it sort of weaves in and out of my life. It's surprising to end up doing some of the things that I did in my 20s. But actually, just a few years ago, I ended up guest curating an exhibit at the Folsom History Museum on Californian history, on California and the Civil War. And I never thought I'd find myself hanging pictures and laying out cases again. But it's fun, and it's wonderful to be able to do it pretty much on my own hook. Guest curating an exhibit is a lot more fun than being a preparator in an urban museum, where you do a lot of polishing.
Well, I'd like to go back to just before the Civil War. And you say California was a state, and you mentioned this duel. Yeah. This was in late 1859. And who were the participants in this duel?
The first participant that really gets prominent is this man called David Terry, who was a ferocious duelist. He was a Southerner whose family had grown up on the Texas frontier, which is a violent place, and he was a violent man. He was a lawyer, and he was involved in the terrible vigilante violence. Actually, he was a judge at that point, and he expressed his judicial position by burying a Bowie knife in the neck of a culprit. The man miraculously survived, and Terry was not hanged. Terry went on to become the Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court. It was that kind of a place back then. There was a very rough scene.
So when they say the Wild West.
They meant it. One of the fellows who was involved in that whole vigilante business was a gentleman by the name of William Sherman, who actually worked with Terry at that point to try to suppress the vigilantes. So Terry is an ardent Southerner, no question about where he stood on slavery. And he and the leadership of the California Democratic Party at that point were intent on getting California divided and have one half of it be a slave state. They regarded it as critical to the survival of slavery to have more votes in the U.S. Senate. So you have Terry working with the Democratic leadership, which called itself the chivalry, right? They were all Southern aristocrats. And he ran, originally, actually, in the vigilante days, he was a friend of a young man called David Broderick, who was a Democrat also, but of a completely different stripe. David Broderick was the son of a stonemason. He grew up in New York City. He learned his politics in Tammany Hall, and they were a rough, very rough form of politics. And his interest was in directing the Democratic Party towards a free soil stance. And you can see the clash coming here. Terry lost his seat on the Supreme Court in election. He blamed Broderick. They traded insults. And in those days, that's not something you did without consequences. So after a few exchanges, they decided that they had to settle this thing in the honorable way. And they did so by Lake Merced on the peninsula. They were both accomplished fighters. But David Terry's folks had the choice of weapons. And that turned out very badly for Broderick because the pistols were not equal and Broderick's was hair-triggered. So when Broderick raised his gun, it went off and the bullet plowed into the ground. And Terry raised his gun and put a bullet through Broderick's lung. Well, at about that time, the electorate of California began to get tired of Democratic politics. That people were beginning to say, this isn't right. You know, they need to settle their differences some other way. And just at that time, the Republican Party was beginning to move in terms of public support. And things like this Broderick-Terry duel did wonders for people's interest in that Republican Party. And so in the very next election, you actually have the Northern Democrats joining together with the insurgent Republicans to back the Union. And basically, they wrested control of the state from that pro-Southern Democratic leadership.
Yeah, so when we talk about the Democratic Party in California, we're actually talking about two factions. The Northern and the Southern Democrats did not see eye to eye.
Really, at the end of the pre-war period, you have to consider them as separate institutions because they would both run candidates. They'd run separate candidates. And that was simply a mirror of what was happening nationally because in the 1860 election, Abraham Lincoln got into the White House because and only because the Democrats couldn't agree on a candidate. And they ran Stephen Douglas for the people in the North, and they ran Breckinridge for the people in the South.
In fact, you have a graph, a pie chart, that yes. I found very helpful. You have one for the national election and one for the California election. And to see those percentages of how, gosh, Lincoln barely made it.
Oh,
and
amazing.
And in California, he got, what, 0.5%?
Yeah, he just barely got it. He got 32% of the vote. He didn't even get a third of the votes. But the election actually was a four-way race. The people we haven't talked about yet were the Constitutional Unionists. And they were people from the Upper South who were in favor of slavery, but also were quite stern about having the Constitution protected and were against secession. And so they actually won in Virginia and I believe Kentucky. They did very well in the Upper South. And they were out here too in California. They voted for Judge Bell. So when the dust settled, Lincoln sneaks into California's electoral votes by about 700 ballots.
So he barely squeaked by.
Yeah.
My guest is Richard Hurley, and he has written the history of California. Well, you have researched the history of California and the Civil War and written a book that includes wonderful photographs and illustrations. And I just mentioned a graph that you had, a pie chart of how the election went in 1860. Then there's a figure that I have known since I was a child because I, from a young age, visited Shiloh Battlefield. And I remember this picture of, and it couldn't have been a photograph, it had to have been an illustration, of Albert Sidney Johnson leaning
yes.
against a tree.
Yes.
And that was burned into my memory. And so I particularly enjoyed reading what you had to say about this figure, Albert Sidney Johnston.
It's one of the many really tragic stories that came out of that time. It was a very cruel time, and it landed on Sidney Johnston. He was one of the nation's most distinguished soldiers going into the late 1850s. He had about every important command that you could have.
Yeah, because a lot of these characters in your book are somewhat despicable.
Oh, yeah.
There are a few. But not Albert Sidney Johnson,
no,
I found.
No, a remarkable man. He was appointed by the Buchanan administration to be the commander of the U.S. Army Department of the Pacific, and that included California and basically the whole Pacific coast. His appointment came late in 1859, and at that point, our politics were so polarized that many people in the North and in California assumed that Sidney Johnston was appointed as part of a conspiracy. That turned out not to be the case. Sidney Johnston, so long as he wore a blue uniform, acted in complete good faith. He fortified the San Francisco Bay. He made sure that weapons that were vulnerable in arsenals that could have been seized by secessionists were tucked away, moved a lot of hardware to Alcatraz Island. He, however, finally had to confront his situation. His loyalty was to Texas. That was his adopted state. And when Texas went out, Sidney Johnson offered his resignation.
And a demotion.
From general, which is very hard to achieve in those days, to private. Sidney Johnson went to Los Angeles. He hoped to retire because his sister and brother-in-law were there. But it turned out that the pressure on him from Southern partisans was acute. And you have to understand that Southern California was, in fact, vigorously pro-Southern. And Los Angeles was a hotbed of secession.
And pro-slavery.
Pro-slavery, too. And so Sidney Johnston enlists as a private in the Los Angeles Mounted Rifles. And they are a pro-secesh militia unit that decides they cannot sit this thing out. And so their decision was to cross the Southwest in June and July, and not peak travel seasons, in Arizona, New Mexico, through the Apaches, right along next to the Comanches, and dodging Union Army patrols. And they ride across the entire Southwest, and it's about 800 miles, and they get to Mesilla, and then they've got another 700 miles to get to San Antonio. And Sidney Johnson.
I want to remind people, this is in the midsummer now, a desert in midsummer.
120 degrees. Was one of the temperatures cited, and that would have been in the shade if there had been any. it was a terrible ordeal, and really it was a matter of life and death getting to the next water hole. So the South, of course, was elated when Sidney Johnson emerges, to take command of the Confederate forces that were in the West. Actually, it was Davis who appointed him to that post.
Jefferson Davis, who was president of the Confederacy.
And an old friend of Johnston's. And he said, if Sidney Johnston isn't the general, we don't have any generals. That was his response to somebody who questioned the appointment. And Johnston then, of course, went on, as you mentioned, to the Battle of Shiloh, where he came within a hair's breadth of throwing General Grant, the young General Grant, into the Tennessee River. The battle was a horrific introduction to the war to come. There was over 20,000 casualties, and the casualties on that day were greater than the cumulative casualties of all U.S. troops in all wars fought to that point. And of course, Sidney Johnson decided that he had to lead from the front, and the current theory is that he took a Confederate bullet, that he was too far in the front. And he was hit in a leg that had been wounded in a duel, and he couldn't feel the wound. And by the time he did, it was too late. He bled to death.
Well, even the circumstances, it seemed to me from what you wrote that it was not necessary, and what I've read other sources, that it wasn't really necessary that he die, that a tourniquet could have saved his leg.
And he just sent his doctor over.
And he just sent his physician over to take care of Yankee.
Yankee wounded.
Wounded.
Yes. So, of course, that kind of story was that became very dear to the Southern partisans. That he represented their idea of chivalry in reality. I mean, he was that sort of person.
Well, I want to get back to this charismatic speaker photographed, although you don't see him, on the cover of your book. But we are going to take a short break. Okay. And when we get back, I want to ask you about that speaker.
Okay.
You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman.
Thank you.
I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest today has been interested in history since he was 10 years old and has studied California history, in particular, the era of the Civil War in California. He has a new book, California and the Civil War. Richard Hurley is he has had experience with multimedia presentations that he did when he wrote his first book with his co-author, T.J. Meekins. And his new book is full of wonderful stories of the characters who played such an important role in the history of California during the Civil War. One of these characters, and I'm going to call him a character because he sounds like he's definitely a character, was this little guy who worked for the Union cause, and he really persuaded people of his point of view. Who was this person?
He was a frail, very frail young man whose father was a cobbler in the Boston area. And his father felt the call and became a minister. He died at an early age, as most of the men in his family did, leaving young Starr, as they called him, Thomas Starr King, in charge of the family. Starr King was 15 years old at the time. And so he had to take a full-time job as a clerk in a Navy yard. And yet, he was so brilliant that he became a cause for the New England intelligentsia. And the list of his private tutors is like the honor roll of Boston's intellectuals at the time. So without any formal education beyond his 15th year, he was reading and writing in Hebrew and Greek and German. And I can't even remember the full list, but he was a genius. I mean, I don't use that term very often. He was also a great human being. And that's what attracted people to him. It wasn't his scholarliness. It was his sense of humor. He was very adept at putting people at their ease. He could laugh at himself. And at a time when laughter was desperately needed, he provided some. But he also provided leadership, you know, intellectual leadership. So in order to support his family, he's still in Boston at this point, he goes on speaking tours, this Lyceum lecture tour. And here he is, a fellow with no college experience at all, giving lectures on Goethe and Socrates, or Socrates, as a lot of the people who went to his lectures thought, it should be said. And he became pretty famous, but he wore himself out. He was in poor health, so he decided, his judgment wasn't always that keen. He decided that what he needed to do was come out to a vacancy in San Francisco. There was a pulpit out here. The Unitarians, First Unitarians in San Francisco, needed a preacher.
He was a reverend, yeah.
He was an ordained minister in the Universalist and Unitarian schools. He actually taught from both pulpits, which is a very interesting place theologically. I don't know if we have time to go there, but it was quite an interesting and avant-garde kind of religion for the time. So he ends up coming out here because he thinks that this pulpit in San Francisco means that he won't have to do the lecture tour anymore. And he can sort of hoard his resources and spend some time with his family. This turned out to be a grave mistake because he was such a gifted speaker. What happened was that the California Unionists were terribly short of public spokesmen at this point. I won't go into the details, but Leland Stanford was a terrible public speaker.
Leland, let me repeat that name, because that's one that's very familiar in California. Okay. Leland Stanford.
Stanford was the leading Republican.
Was a boring speaker.
Was, yeah, slow. Great businessman, but wasn't anybody's idea of a good political candidate. As a matter of fact, he got something like less than 10% of the vote the first time he ran for governor. People just fell asleep at his lectures.
And here, on the other hand, was this young Starr, that was his name, Starr King. What a great name.
Yes.
Huh?
Yes. And he was just an electric personality. You know, his quote about his weight, it was, I may only weigh 120 pounds, but when I'm mad, I weigh a ton. Another great quote came out of the speaking tours that he was quickly enlisted to undertake. And they would be to any place that offered him a lectern. The man was a workaholic. We would recognize that now. And so he'd get calls from mining camps that were largely secessionist because he was such an entertaining speaker. And they just heard, you know, the guy's funny. He may be crazy and he's a Yankee, but hey, you know, what else is happening? So they'd invite him out there. And one of the ways they tested the speaker's nerve was to take a pistol, aim it at the guy's head as he walks into the room, and snap it and see if he flinches. And it was essential to show no reaction to this, you know, just sort of go on your way and let them have their fun. This, mind you, in a state that led all the states of the Union in the murder rate. And King was a genuinely brave man, and he was also funny. He wrote back to his friend Jesse Fremont, who was the wife of the, you know,
John
General
C. Fremont.
Right. He and Jesse Fremont formed a very close friendship. And he wrote to Jesse, I never knew.
And you know what? Excuse me, but have her picture in there also.
Yes, I do.
Jesse Fremont.
Yes.
And she's not quite as impressive as some of the other women who look so elegant. And she.
She's a very impressive person. She looks pretty stern in that picture.
Yeah, she does in her photograph. But anyway, back to the story.
Well, she's saying, Star King's writing her. And he says, I never knew the exhilaration of public speaking until I faced a front row of men armed with Bowie knives and revolvers. So he took it all in stride. And what was memorable, what comes through in the accounts of his life, is the fact that he could put people at their ease. So while he never wavered in his support for the Union, he took the standpoint that the Southerners needed to be brought back to the benefits of Union. He didn't want to threaten and berate. He wanted to cajole. And he also wanted to do it with grace and humor, but he did it firmly. He also devoted his energies to raising money for the wounded soldiers. This was something that the government didn't do back then. If you were wounded in the Union Army, you relied on a private organization to have your family sustained during your disability or to, you know, sustain them after your death. That was done by an organization called the Sanitary Commission. And Star King got a hold of this through a series of accidents. People just sent him some money and said, you know, if you deal with this money, put it to good use. And so he said, okay, yeah, I'll do that. And once he found out how popular donations to the Sanitary Commission were, that gave him another cause. And he raised money by the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And he sent it back east. To the fellow who was the head of the Sanitary Commission, who was a personal friend, another minister in the Unitarian line. And Star King and California became the mainstay. California was a tiny state in terms of population. It donated a quarter of all the money that went to the Sanitary Commission. The sad ending of this story was the typical one for a workaholic. Star King didn't know how to say no. So while he was doing all these tours and building a new church in San Francisco and taking his congregation out of debt and personally supervising the careers of scores of people out of the goodness of his heart, he worked himself to death. He got diphtheria, and then that turned into pneumonia. And of course, he spent his expiring days consoling his family and friends who came to see him. So He was such a remarkable man that San Francisco closed down when he died. The state legislature was adjourned so that the politicians could come. It took 3 days off so they could come to San Francisco for the funeral. Foreign ships in San Francisco Bay lowered their flags. And he's one of these people who's a hero as much as any man that walked out onto a battlefield. He did give his life for the Union. It's just that he found another way to do it.
My guest is Richard Hurley, and he has written a book about California and its experience during the Civil War, California and the Civil War. And he's just described the life of a guy who was really a hero, who worked for the Union cause. And you mentioned that some Californians went back east to fight, and this surprised me. Maybe it surprised you too.
It did.
When you tell the story of the California volunteers, and how did they, you mentioned that they couldn't rely on the government organizations to pay your expenses for things.
Very much not the case.
And
yes.
So how did California volunteers get back east, and where did they go, and why did they go there?
Well, they went there because there were a lot of Union volunteers in California. 15,750 men eventually took up Union Blue during that time, mostly from the north of the state, as it happens. And what happened to them was that they enlisted in the full flush of patriotism, and they were all set to go fight rebels. Only the rebels refused to oblige here. You know, the people we had here were just more interested in mining gold for the most part. So what happened was that they were all sent to replace the regular army in the West. And they did. They replaced the entire pre-war army all over the West. And they ended up in these really gritty, harsh Indian campaigns. So they were fighting the Shoshone and the Dene and the Apaches and the Comanche and the Kiowa.
Probably thinking, this is not what I signed up for. I want to fight and kill rebels.
Well, they did because they felt like the Union was, I mean, it was an existential threat. And they were, you know, inflamed with the passions of their time. And they, you know, everybody at that point knew that the Indians were going to lose that contest overall. And so they were, you know, most Californians are perfectly okay with letting someone else, you know, deal with the end of the Indian War story. But the U.S. government couldn't afford to bring those people back to fight rebels because they were needed in the West. The Indians weren't slow to figure out that a civil war among the whites was their best chance. And so there was a lot of Indian expansion during that time. The Comanche frontier, the Comanches actually had an empire, an inland empire in Texas, and their borders expanded 100 miles over the course of the Civil War. They weren't going to give up. So as soon as the U.S. Army was withdrawn to fight back east, a lot of Indian tribes said, okay. And in fact, some of them were convinced that it was their resistance that had caused the white soldiers to go. Mind, they don't get newspapers, you know, out there in the Arizona desert. So the Apaches, for instance, were convinced that their resistance had succeeded. So the Californians who have that experience write back very angry letters saying, I didn't sign up to be out here in New Mexico where it's very cold in the winter, where it's incredibly hot in the summer and very dusty all the time. So the Unionists, the young men who really did want to fight, got together and they created a very clever scheme. They wrote to Governor John Andrew of Massachusetts. These were young men primarily based in San Francisco initially, most of them from New England. And they said, Dear Governor Andrew, the War Department, you know, if we sign up, we know what's going to happen to us and we don't want to do that. We would really like to fight for the Union. Can you help us? And they offered to pay pretty much their own way. They raised money for the regiment. The actual transport was paid by the state of Massachusetts, so the ship passage. And they did. They went right around Panama and all the way back up into Boston. And originally there were 100 of them. They were cavalrymen because the Union cavalry, frankly, wasn't very good. And Californians had a terrific reputation as horsemen. So they raised initially that troop, and then it was a popular program, and more people joined. So eventually you had the equivalent of a battalion of California cavalrymen who fought in the 2nd Massachusetts Volunteer Cavalry. They fought under a Boston Brahmin, a very, very brave young man by the name of Lowell, who was tubercular before the war, but decided that this was no time to be tubercular. So he went and led them. And their job was to go chase John Mosby across northern Virginia.
And this was a different kind of warfare than
it was.
Where you stand in lines and shoot at each other with rifles.
No, this is ambush. And that's why it was important to have good horsemen. Most of them saw their first combat when they were just attacked from ambush. And their first job was to run for their lives or to stage an ambush. But it was all done on horseback. And it was very rough work. Of the 502 who enlisted, 182 were still in service at the end of the war. So the death rate was horrific. And the worst part was not dying. It was being captured because the people, the Union soldiers who were captured in that theater, were sent to Andersonville. And it's just better to get it over than be killed on the battlefield. And that's how they felt about it. There's a pretty fair amount of literature where they express that sentiment.
This is where Northern Yankee Union soldiers were sent to this place, Andersonville in Georgia.
Yeah, and it was just the dark side of hell. It was the worst prison camp. Georgia was running out of food, and they couldn't feed their own soldiers, and they weren't going to spend any time feeding Yankee soldiers. And there was a lot of mismanagement involved, and it's just a very dark story. And yeah.
Well, somebody that I admired from what I read in your book was, you mentioned this guy named Charles Lowell, mm-hmm. who was a colonel, mm-hmm. and I thought he was a sympathetic character in your book.
Very much so. I went to Harvard, and actually it turned out my daughter went there for her graduate school, so I took her to Memorial Hall and made her look at the plaque to Lowell.
And she took it very alumnus. Well.
Yes. They, actually, they have an entire building there dedicated to the Civil War dead. Harvard was pruned back pretty severely because it was still a fairly local college then, and the Massachusetts area provided a lot of Union officers, and they died in very large numbers. So you can walk into this thing that's basically a Romanesque cathedral, and the entire nave is lined floor to ceiling with plaques of men who died. So actually, Lowell was a valedictorian at Harvard. He had a great future, and unfortunately had poor health, but he had, he was committed. And so despite the fact that he would have been deferred without any question, he served, and he was very good at it.
Beyond what would be required there toward the end.
He had 13 horses shot out from under him during one campaign.
And you look at his photograph, here's this kind of skinny little guy that you mentioned he had tuberculosis. He didn't look like he could hold up very well.
Well, the good news is, as a colonel, he wasn't expected to actually do the sabering. And there are other pictures of the California volunteers. You say, that's the guy who did the hard fighting. But Lowell had to provide the leadership, and he had to provide the esprit. So he did that at the cost of his own life. He was wounded at Cedar Creek, which is an important battle in the towards the end of the war. It was the Union victory, the essential Union victory in the Shenandoah Valley. And he was badly wounded. A bullet hit him in the chest. And because he was tubercular, he had extreme difficulty breathing. And he said, "Don't take me away." They dragged him back, put him, built a little earth mound for him. He lay there for 2 hours awaiting the final charge that everybody knew was going to happen. And when that order came through to charge, they dragged him out, put him up on top of his horse, and everybody cheered when he waved his saber. And off they went. The charge was unsuccessful, and Lowell got another bullet that did his business. But he lingered for a while and was one of these people like Starr King who sort of calmly conducted his own death. He wrote dispatches and a letter to his wife and then expired.
My guest is Richard Hurley, and he is author of California and the Civil War, a new book about the Civil War and California's experience. And you've just told us about the volunteers, California volunteers, who went back east to fight. And there was an Englishman who fought for the other side. he thought that the South needed some financial support. because the South had expected, we'll just sell our cotton to England, we're in good shape, and instead the cotton was rotting in their warehouses there in the South. So how did this Englishman, this Confederate conspirator, come into play? What was his role?
Well, he actually probably was one of the leaders of the conspiracy, but we learn about the conspiracy through a Kentucky aristocrat by the name of Asbury Harpending. And so the Englishman was kind of along for the ride as far as Harpending's discussion of it is concerned. There's a lot of good reasons to doubt Harpending's recount. But that said, it's Harpending's materials online, and I highly recommend it. He's a very gifted writer, and he's very funny, and he's just a precious insight into the mindset of a young Southern aristocrat with a lot of nerve. And apparently no fear.
Well, in case people do want to Google him, again, his name is Harpending. Asbury. H-A-R-P-E-N-D-I-N-G.
Yes. I really recommend it. He's a superb storyteller. And so I'll tell it from Harpending's standpoint. He wanted to capture Union gold supplies. And they were all going back east on the Pacific steamships. And a lot of people tried to capture the gold on land.
Just like they want to take it off the stagecoaches.
Right.
And
but this, I like this approach. This is good. He bought himself, or actually Rubery, one of his associates from Kentucky, and the young Englishman pooled their resources, and they bought a schooner. And the schooner was a preferred rig for this kind of thing because it is fast. You could really rip in a schooner, and it was very maneuverable. And you could get just enough iron onto it to sink a mailboat. So your threat was credible, and the steamships would have to stop. So they located this very, very fast schooner, and they stock it full of weapons. And then they also recruit from a nearby castle of the Knights of the Golden Circle. That's a secret society, pro-Southern society.
You have an illustration in your book, by the way.
Yes,
it's not a photograph, of course, but an illustration.
No photographs. They were pretty secretive and for very good reasons. But they did actually have a training camp. They had a guerrilla. We'd call them guerrillas now. They called them partisan rangers. They had a training camp in the Santa Cruz Mountains. And so they had this crew of desperados, basically, who were going to come on board, and then they were going to sail out of San Francisco Bay and go get those steamships. And it sounds so implausible now, but I think they might have actually succeeded because they got as far as they did. They got all their weapons on board. They ordered two cannons. Nobody stopped to say, wait a minute now, gentlemen. Actually, their cover story was that they needed them for their mining interests in Mexico. It says a lot about Mexico that this story passed because Mexico was in pretty severe disarray too. But they did they hired a navigator who was an expert seaman, but he and a Southern partisan, but he got cold feet, and so he blabbed. He turned them in, and so the morning of sailing came, and the navigator didn't show up. And they're moored, they've already slipped, they're out in the channel, they're moored, they're ready to go. And what shows up at dawn is a couple of steamboats of San Francisco policemen and a couple of boats from the USS Cyan, a federal sloop of war. And so they spent a few anxious minutes eating their dispatches and their correspondence.
Yeah, it looked like a movie when you were describing this, eating their dispatches.
And apparently they didn't eat enough because they were convicted. And they got quite severe sentences. They were all convicted. They were going to be put away for 10 years because this was piracy. They could have been hanged. But Harpending had taken the precaution of getting a letter of marque, he said, from Jefferson Davis. We suspect, in fact, that it was from a Confederate agent in Veracruz.
But at least he had the paper.
He did have the paper.
Official paper.
Yes, and the other thing was he had the courage to go across Mexico in the midst of a civil war to get the paper. So I don't blame Harpending for lying. If you're a guerrilla leader or a privateer, lying is part of your trade. You better be good at it because you're never going to be ahead in terms of armament. You better be ahead in terms of lying power. And Harpending certainly was. And the young Brit was actually pardoned by Abraham Lincoln because his uncle was a parliamentary leader by the name of John Bright, as I recall. And he was a very ardent spokesman for the Union in England. And that turned out to be a very important matter because the British were in a position to close the Union blockade down in a matter of weeks. They could have swept the American Navy from the seas. And if the South had succeeded in getting its cotton to market, it would have completely transformed their economic position. They would have been able to buy weapons, medicines, would have been a godsend, food, whatever they needed. So it was a life and death matter, really, having that blockade there. And so Lincoln said, in return for your wonderful oratory, Mr. Bright, your wayward nephew can go back to England. Just don't have him come back here anytime soon.
My guest is Richard Hurley. He lives in Nevada City now, and right in the middle of a hotbed of strong sentiments during the Civil War here in California, where it pitted secessionist against unionist here in California. Then you've described how California was really a prize that both sides in the Civil War were hoping to get California
yes.
In their camp.
And with good reason. Jefferson Davis really did believe that California was going to go his way. He had contact with our southern-based senator, a man called William Gwynne, who was a Mississippi plantation owner who just came out here because he figured California, new state, they're going to need a senator, and I can't think of a better guy than me.
Well, you know, excuse me for interrupting, sure. But you have a photograph of his wife,
oh, yes.
Mrs. Gwynne, and oh my gosh, she yes. would have put any spender to shame. It was astounding what she spent
yes.
on social, yes. social activities.
Yes, her social budget would be the equivalent of about $1.5 million a year in today's money.
That's
yes.
astounding.
Yes.
So I wonder, too,
yeah.
about her husband's motives. Well, I think I'll go to California.
Well, he was a seasoned politician who needed a bigger venue, you know, for his ambitions. He'd actually been a young clerk for Andrew Jackson. And so he knew the Democratic political system very well, and he'd you know, received patronage and given patronage. He knew how it all worked. So he came out here literally in 49 looking to become senator. And he shows up at the Constitutional Convention and says, here I am, boys. And at first he wasn't well received. You know, people who had been here a long time, you know, 6 months, a year or something like that, looked askance at him. But it turned out he was the only competent politician, you know, there. And so when they needed to figure out how to put together a state constitution, he helped them with that. And he also struck the vital note, which was, he says, you know what, we better come in as a free state. Which is a very odd position. Now remember, he's a plantation owner.
From Mississippi.
From Mississippi owner. Owned slaves, plenty of them.
And, can't get any deeper south than that.
That's the heart of it. And, well, maybe South Carolina, but it's pretty southern. But his thinking was this. They would need northern support to get California accepted into the Union. And they would need local California 49er support to get the Constitution passed. The local miners had no interest in black slavery because they were all afraid of competing with slave-powered mining companies. And that was a unanimous vote. Miners from the South as well as from the North did not want black slavery out here. They didn't want blacks either. There was going to be a ban on blacks coming into the state, and it failed by one vote.
Well, this story is so fascinating, and to see how California almost came in on the side of the South. That's what it looked
strange.
Like. So
yeah.
I think people will really enjoy your book.
Okay.
Thank you for writing this, Richard.
Oh, well, thank you very much for having me today.
My guest has been Richard Hurley, and his new book is California and the Civil War. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.